fascinating story. And as you can tell, I'm enthusiastic to talk about the memoirs of a blind biker, Russell Targ. Like a blind biker, perhaps on a country road, there are a lot of twists and turns you don't see coming in this story and in this interview, but you're going to love this guy. If you've never heard him before or heard about him on Coast to Coast, it'll be all new to you. But even if you have, there's many more details I never knew about. We'll get to them next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnet. Well, I do want to get to some of your early years as well as how you made the transition into remote viewing. But Russell Targ, if I can ask you to start by explaining the blind part of the title and talk about facial blindness. And thanks again for agreeing to be a guest tonight.
Well, I'm very happy to be with you this evening. I grew up with radio, spent years and years sitting around in the dark listening to great people, Gene Shepard and the great New York broadcasters who just talked to me through the symphony, Sid. Great people just talk through the night. My vision was very poor, so I listened to the radio instead of reading comic books. And I always had problems recognizing people, and I thought that was because of my bad vision. But it turns out there's something called face blindness that I had not known about until I started writing my memoirs. And face blindness really doesn't pertain to bad vision at all. There's a whole category of people with normal vision who simply don't recognize other people. Now, in my case, with glasses and bad vision, I just thought it was ordinary. But as I began to look at it, it turns out it's an anomaly that we're able to do as well as we can recognizing people. We are exceptionally gifted in our ability to tell people from one another. Can see people you went to kindergarten with and recognize them 50 years later. And I don't have that ability because the sprouting in the brain that's necessary for that to take place didn't take place in me because of the bad vision. So my poor vision caused me to eventually develop face blindness.
Well, and so this means that, as you write about in the book, your closest friends who, you know, people who know you and it, know your condition the best are the ones who are the ones most likely to always reintroduce themselves to you?
That's right. If we have a party or a reception, it's the people I've known for 30 years who will walk up and say, "Hi, Russell, it's Arthur." And, of course, I've known Arthur for 35 years, but he knows that I'm very good at faking it, talking about this and that until I figure out who people are, which is something that everyone does.
Right.
But the people who know me really well just tell me who they are, and then we can pick up where we left it off. But it's interesting that, in general, people are very attached to the story of who they are, to their own little ego and to their own appearance. And what I've learned is that is a great source of suffering arises from the fact that if you think that who you are, then every day when you look in the mirror in the morning, you're apt to be disappointed. So one of the things that the Buddhists teach is to recognize that there is much more and greater difference to who you are than to what you see in the mirror and to your story. So it's a great effort to convince people to separate themselves from believing that who they are is what it says on their business card.
But I imagine there's a lot of people that you see regularly who then, as you point out, because we're attached to our egos, who don't quite get it, and they think that after meeting you a few times, you're supposed to remember who they are. And so, you know, they will almost expect or feel bruised that you don't remember their face because, you know, once we meet somebody three or four times, generally most people kind of remember who they are. Maybe it's a few more times than that, but it's somewhere along the line you do, and you just don't. And that must really kind of rock their
That's
world.
Right. It annoys people. They feel that I'm rude or arrogant. I've been teaching remote viewing for quite a number of years now, since the end of the Stanford Research Institute program. So I'll have 30 or 40 people in my weekend workshop where I'm showing them how to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic. And I will say at the outset, I'm here for the weekend. I'm very happy to chat with you after class anytime, but I'm not going to recognize you. So please don't take it personally. If you want to talk to me, just come up to me, tell me who you are, that you're in my class. I'll be happy to chat with you. But don't expect me to see you and recognize you in the dining hall or on the path, because that's not going to happen. And that sort of solves the problem. People will always come up to me and say that they're having a good time, or tell them about forecasting the stock market or healing the sick or some other thing, and I'm happy to chat with them. And if I sort of defuse it up front, I say, I'm happy to have you here, just don't expect me to recognize you.
Well, I think that's very interesting, and I just, for the first time, I think I'll have to be more sensitive to other people out there who might have that, because is it fair to say it's a growing condition, or the condition isn't growing, but awareness of it is?
Well, awareness of it is growing, and like so many things, awareness comes from the internet. So if you go to Google and look at face blindness, there are quite a number of people who have very expanded sites talking about face blindness and what their problems are and what it means and how you learn to tell one person from another. And it turns out the face blind people, as I do, tend to have friends. Their good friends are unusual. Like, they'll be tall, or they'll have long hair or blue eyes or some unusual feature. And those are people you tend to glom onto, because you can find them in the dark, or you can find them in a crowd. My wife is quite tall, as am I, and she has longish red hair. But in a store, she will find me sidling up to some other tall blonde woman and say, no, it's not me. Hi, Russ, I'm over here.
That's a great excuse. All right, so I love the there's sort of this theme about women that runs through your book too, which I got a kick out of it. And I don't know where we're going to end up.
That even shy blind people can find girlfriends.
Yeah. Sometimes reading your story here, I don't think shyness is really your problem. I mean, I think there's so many interesting things though from the very beginning. Let's just establish that you were as a young student, you were a prodigy, and that you got advanced many times, so that you ended up in college right around the age of 16 or so?
Yes.
Okay.
I moved from city to city, and I skipped grades when I moved frequently. I managed to skip a couple of grades in junior high school and high school.
And getting into, you were a kind of, obviously, you were just by nature an innovator and a pioneer, and you had this boundless curiosity. And I track with that, and I love the ways in which you explore things about the world. But let's skip forward a few spaces to that conversation you had with a friend who would later end up becoming actually quite a mover and a shaker in his own right. But you had some just an early glimpse about what ESP was about. And talk about how ESP was introduced to you.
Well, I'm not sure what friend you meant about ESP. ESP was introduced to me as a college student. I was a magician.
Right.
That as a young person, I got interested in magic. Young person interested in magic, like many, many people are. And because I lived in New York, I had access to magic stores and to magicians and people doing magic. On 42nd Street, for example, in Times Square, I could go to the Hubert's Flea Circus under the shooting gallery and stand right next to the magician doing tricks on the stage and watch him vanishing things and make them reappear. And then I could go upstairs to the stores and buy tricks, buy books, talk to magicians, and become acquainted with the magical art, which is what I did through college and graduate school. I would I was a performing magician, and it was really my contact with magic that got me interested in ESP. Because one of the tricks that magicians like to do, so-called mental magic, is when you're on the stage pretending to read the mind of somebody in the audience. And they call it billet reading, very popular even in churches, where everybody will write a question on a slip of paper and put it in his or her envelope. And then the magician will appear to take an envelope, hold it to his forehead, divine the question, and give an answer. Now, of course, the magician's already read one of the questions, so to prime the pump. So I would stand, for example, with a piece of paper in an envelope, my eyes closed, standing in the lights, and I would say, there's a woman in the audience who's lost her dog. And I would say that because I knew for a fact there was such a woman because I had already read her piece of paper. And she'd say, oh, yes, yes, Mr. Targ, can you find my dog? Which I, of course, could not do. But often with the necessity level rising, as Ingo Swann would say, the lights are in my eyes, there's an audience filled with expectation, I would often get other pictures of what her house looked like, the tree in the front yard, the steps going up to her bedroom, the patchwork quilt on the bed. So I could supplement what's a ordinary trick by whatever ESP came my way. And even the magicians who hate ESP, which is the usual situation, will agree that from time to time, psychic information does come to them, and then they can fold that into whatever they're doing. And then as a young physics student, it became obvious to me that it's much more interesting to study the ESP rather than do stage magic. And I went to talk to J.B. Ryan at Duke University and acquainted myself with professional parapsychology and then went off in that direction. Now, well, of course, I was aware that it's very tough to make a living doing ESP research. So I got my degree in physics, but I always had a parallel trajectory interested in psychic stuff.
Well, I was referring to page 31 of your book and where you said, in high school, I was introduced to ESP by my classmate Robert Rosenthal.
Oh, Robert Rosenthal, yes, indeed.
Who later goes on to become a distinguished Harvard psychology professor. And you wrote about how you, 60 years later, you went back to credit him with your first introduction and your interest in ESP. That's why I went there. But
yeah, thank you. Yeah, Rosenthal is a distinguished psychologist. And it happened that he went to the same crummy high school I did in Queens, New York. I don't know why Rosenthal was going there, but people often get really terrible advice from their junior high school guidance counselor.
Right.
Now, my vision was very poor. I was a legally blind student with even less accommodation for my glasses than I have now. And my guidance counselor in high school told my parents, this kid can't see very well, but maybe he could be a farmer. So they sent me to an agricultural high school.
Right.
Now, that's really a terrible idea because people with really bad vision can't tell a vegetable from a weed. And also because of my vision, I don't like being out in the sun. So that was a particularly bad choice. But I made friends there and had a wonderful contact with the physics professor in the high school. And then I discovered I wanted to be a physicist and not a farmer.
Well,
but Rosenthal was indeed the first person to show me ESP cards.
You talk about an early encounter with Peter Hurkos.
I'd like to mention that the book we're talking about is Do You See What I See, which is my autobiography. And yes, I did run into Peter Hurkos. He was a Dutch psychic. He's one of the people like Pat Price or Uri Geller, who I met later on, who could really read your mind and just look at you and describe what you're thinking. He was a pretty much functional alcoholic. That is, he drank all the time, but I never saw him drunk. It just lubricated his ability. And there are many people like that. The author James T. Farrell was another person I knew. and others who just drink all the time, doesn't seem to impair their functioning, but it's something that his friends have to get used to. But Peter Hurkacz was able to... Peter Hurkacz really was the first person to interest me in contacting deceased people.
Well, I think that's the part that's interesting. I think of the many early, well-known believers in ESP or these extraordinary possibilities of the brain, I think Peter Hurkacz was an early evangelist. He converted many. And I think some of the people we've heard over the years, one way or another, we find out that they're not all that they were supposedly, or they did some parlor tricks along the way. But it always seemed like Peter Hurkacz, who was Dutch, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
That he did some of the most extraordinary things. If you could talk a little bit
about a lot of Dutch psychics, because the Dutch did not kill the witches during the Inquisition. The Dutch were very tolerant. So you have a superabundance of Dutch psychics because they survived the witch burning craze.
Talk a little bit about what Peter Hurkacz did a little bit that made such an impression on you that he was one of the real ones.
Well, he did a couple of things for me. At a big sitting we went to, he was going to describe things that people brought up to the stage. And one of the elements that I brought up to the stage was a early glass hologram. And with a hologram of a railroad train, and was all wrapped up in paper and cardboard, and he held this picture in his hand, and he just went on and on about the energy. A hologram, of course, is made by shining a laser beam on the film. So he did not see the train, but he was just overcome with all the energy and the sparkles associated with this thing. And this was in the 60s, where holograms were quite rare and nobody had seen any. But I was impressed that he could detect the energy of that just by holding it in his hand. And I once gave him a smooth rock that belonged to my mother, who is deceased. And he sort of took on her personality and had friendly but dismissive words like, "I'm fine now, Russ, just live your own life and leave me alone," which is the kind of thing that my mother might say to me. And she walked back and forth with her persona. And that was really my first contact with a person who might be in contact with the deceased spirit. Since I knew the answer in that case, today that wouldn't have excited me as much. I've now seen things that do excite me pertaining to survival. But Peter Hurkacz was my first introduction.
Well, we'll get to that too a little bit later on. I'll jump forward here then, and we'll talk about the remote viewing, having laid the groundwork a little bit for Russell Targ's interest in it. Let's then go forward into the formation of remote viewing, is sort of the way in which remote viewing is understood today. He was there at the beginning. The book is "Do You See What I See? Memoirs of a Blind Biker, Lasers in Love, ESP and the CIA, and the Meaning of Life." We'll get to it all, including how the CIA used Russell Targ, worked with Russell Targ maybe at times too, toward their purposes. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's my fault. Actually, I was just sitting here reading. I just walked out of the room. I was grabbing something. My apologies. I was just picking up a part of the book, "Do You See What I See?" Russell Targ, and I got carried away reading back toward the end when I realized, wait, I am live, and I'm sorry. Let's go to Russell Targ next. Why should I be the only one that knows what's in the book, "The Memoirs of a Blind Biker," next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I know everybody is most interested in those early years, especially of the remote viewing phenomenon. So let's jump ahead a little bit in the life of Russell Targ. How did you get on the ground floor of remote viewing, and talk a little bit about the formation of when this sort of got, you know, formalized, if you will, as being a talent that could be utilized by anybody at will, or for that matter, utilized by the government?
Well, the remote viewing got started partly because I was invited to a conference on speculative technology that NASA held. I mean, all these things have many causes. I was invited to give a talk at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco on psychic things, psychic stuff, what the Russians were doing. This in the 1972, and a NASA administrator heard my talk and thought it was interesting that a scientist was talking about ESP and invited me to come the following week to a conference on speculative technology on St. Simon's Island off the coast of Georgia. And at this conference was the administrator of NASA, Jim Fletcher, and the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke and Wernher von Braun, and many, many NASA luminaries. And I had with me a ESP teaching machine that I had built during this period and showed that to the folks and talked about Soviet research in parapsychology and my own interest using feedback and reinforcement to teach ESP. And I was interested in leaving Sylvania, where I was doing laser work, and creating an ESP laboratory. So I recognized that this was my opportunity to pitch a program to the men who could actually launch my new career.
Right.
So I described the work, and we stood out on the pier with von Braun and Jim Fletcher, and I told them that I could help them bring psychic abilities, basically help astronauts get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic. And von Braun told the people standing there about his psychic grandmother, who always knew when something was going to happen, usually something bad. And in a certain sense, it was von Braun's psychic grandmother that led NASA to give me a program. And I was then able to take NASA money out of this conference, from this conference, and start a program with my colleague Hal Puthoff at Stanford Research Institute. So in the very beginning, we had money, the promise of money from NASA, together with Edgar Mitchell, who was an astronaut, and my administrator, George Pesdert. So we descended on SRI with some big guns from NASA and promised to behave ourselves and not cause a problem. And SRI said, okay, if you come in with money, then you can begin a program. And shortly after that, we got some money from the CIA, because my partner Hal and I had both worked for the CIA in our previous incarnation as laser physicists. So the CIA would listen to our story, and we were able to get a much more fair hearing from the director of intelligence at CIA than a psychologist might. Because we had actually, Hal and I had actually built stuff and done research for the CIA in the scientific or physical arena. So we had dough from CIA and from NASA to start a program. And then it was our very great good fortune that Ingo Swann had heard about our interest in this area. And Swann is a New York psychic and an artist. And he came to SRI to work with us and show us how to do remote viewing, which we, of course, didn't know anything about. We were having people describe objects in boxes and pictures in envelopes. And Swann, who had a prodigious ability, said, it's a waste of my time. It's a trivialization of my ability to look into a room or into an envelope. If I want to see what's in the room, I'll open the door. So Swann taught us and demonstrated that he could focus his attention anywhere on the planet and describe what was there. So that quickly led into a CIA program where we were describing Soviet and Chinese activities and downed Russian airplanes and American hostages in Iran and kidnapped American agents. So we quickly, with Swan's guidance, moved from our relatively mundane, what's in the box, tell me the name of the card. We moved from that kind of ordinary parapsychological research into being a psychic spy for the CIA. And well, the deal that we made with the CIA, see, Hal and I did not go to graduate school and study physics to be psychic spies. The deal we made with the CIA is we'd spend half our time doing operational things for the intelligence community, and the other half, we would do publishable work trying to understand how ESP works. And our very generous and intelligent contract monitor from the CIA agreed to let us do that. So we made a deal with the devil.
What was NASA's hope for the ESP work? I know that you mentioned, you know, they'd be able to be in touch with themselves better or whatever, but what do they have greater goals for the astronauts and this research?
We had talked to a Soviet cosmonaut, Sevastyanov, who described psychic experiences in space where he felt attuned to his spacecraft and to his other cosmonauts. And what I was proposing, and I knew that from the conversations, and I proposed that a person's awareness could be expanded so that he could have a developed intuition. Those people have ideas often what's the matter with their car or how to get it started when it won't start. So I felt it would be very desirable if our astronauts could have that kind of intuitive connection with the spacecraft. And the other thing we proposed to do is see if we could detect changes in a person's brain waves at the time they were functioning psychically. So we had a two-pronged program from NASA, both of which were successful. That the ESP teaching machine program worked. People were able to improve their psychic functioning, and that has become a career for me. That is my great pleasure now that I'm retired from aerospace, is to travel around the world helping people to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic and incorporate that expanded awareness in their lives. So I'm no longer spying for the CIA.
Sure. But part of that spying part was that you were doing some heroic work, if it worked, to be able to tell where somebody was kidnapped or where there was a downed pilot or something. It wasn't only about stealing secrets from another nation.
No, we were doing operational things. The very first operational thing we had for the CIA was to describe what was going on at a Soviet weapons factory. And we worked with a great psychic, Pat Price, who is the retired police commissioner from the city of Burbank, California. And we were given, this was our demonstration of ability test from John McMahon, who was the head of CIA intelligence, is the director of intelligence. He sent his agent to SRI with geographical coordinates. And I then read the coordinates to Pat Price as we were sitting in our little electrically shielded room. And Price then had his task to describe what was going on at those coordinates. And Price would close his eyes and lean back in his chair and describe that he was psychically lying on a building in the sunshine, and a giant crane was rolling back and forth over his body. And he said, this is such a big crane, it has wheels on each side of the building. And he said, I want to draw this. This is the biggest gantry crane I've ever seen. And he made quite a nice architectural drawing of this big eight-wheel crane. And we then ran down to the vault under SRI and showed it to the CIA agent who was there evaluating us. And he then rolled out a big picture of the crane taken by satellite photography. And I show that in the book, that this had been a secret picture.
Right.
In the past, I would have to kill you if I told you this, but now it's declassified under Freedom of Information. And the agent said, you're looking at the right place. Your drawing greatly resembles the photograph of the crane. Can you tell us what they're doing inside the building? So we went back to our shielded room, and Price said that they're fabricating, the Russians are fabricating a big steel sphere, and they're welding it together from orange peel slices, which he called gores, like the gores of it, where you make a dress out of slices so you can make a circular thing.
Right.
And that's what he saw, this big 60-foot diameter sphere. 2 years later, the Russians rolled out the 60-foot diameter sphere. Indeed, it was welded together. And the purpose of this big sphere was a containment vessel for a particle beam weapon to shoot down the satellites that were taking the pictures. So this was a big success. And the idea that no success goes unpunished, no good deed goes unpunished. This was such a strong, striking success that no one else in the Western world knew about, that we then had a congressional inquiry to see if there was some kind of security leak that gave us the information. And all of our supporters from CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and NASA and the Air Force came to Congress, where we stood in the well of the House of Representatives, right where our late great president had to stand to defend his activities. But we had a better outcome. We were not impeached. We were told to press on. And we were basically, Price's great description of the Soviet weapons factory and the particle beam weapon was one of the things that kept us funded for the next decade.
Well, what was your success rate, or how can you measure your accuracy rate for remote viewing? And were there many misses for all of?
Many misses.
Okay.
In the published work, the first thing we published in the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical Engineers were two series of experiments. One with the police commissioner, Pat Price. And after working for a year with Price and Ingo Swann, who were natural lifetime psychics, the CIA wanted to know, can't you find somebody who's a control? Can't you bring in an ordinary person? And the ordinary person I chose was my good friend Hella Hammond, who is a Life magazine photographer, very sophisticated, charming woman. Everyone loved Hella, and she came in and thought it was very entertaining that we would pay her to be a psychic, because that's not at all what her life was about. And she turned out to be the most reliable person on the program as a psychic. She was just had her psychic light hidden under a barrel, had never done this before. And in formal trials with Hella and Pat that we published, we would send Hal put off away somewhere each day to a random place. I would not know where that was. And Hella or Pat would have to describe what it looked like where he was. And then at the end of 9 trials, a judge or a group of judges would have to match up their descriptions with what it looked like at the place. And with Pat Price, his description of where Hal was hiding was correct 7 out of 9 places. That is to say, if Hal Putoff, my partner, was kidnapped 9 days in a row by terrorists, then the psychic policeman would have described where he was correctly 7 out of those 9 days, so that the first place a person looked would have found him. So 7 out of 9 were correct. And with Hella, 5 out of 9 were correct, but the other 4 were second place. So Hella's were as significant as Price's. So our 2 first people with whom we did formal double-blind publishable studies were both significant at odds of 1,000,000 to 1.
That's pretty significant. Did the CIA want you to train the standard CIA agent in remote viewing as something else to put in their, you know,
that's
espionage.
What we were doing. We started the program training people at SRI. We started with six people from Army Intelligence from Fort Meade that Hal and I picked. And one of those people was Joe McMonagle, who turned out to be a exceptionally prodigious psychic and is probably now, 20 years later, the greatest psychic in the world. We didn't know that at the time, of course, but so Ingo trained Hal and me, and we then trained six people from the Army because the Army was tired of finding downed airplanes and missing hostages using psychics from California. There was a big giggle factor where they would, just the idea of psychics in California didn't go down well in Washington, as you can imagine. So they wanted their own stable of psychics, their own psychic remote viewing cadre at Fort Meade in Maryland.
Right.
So we trained six people, and those six people then went on to train numerous others in the intelligence community. See, the big secret with remote viewing that's important to say is that there is no secret. Remote viewing is very, very easy to do. So we trained, Ingo trained us, we trained the Army, and the Army trained the world. So that if somebody thinks remote viewing is secret, they should just go to Google. And if you search on Google with remote viewing in quotation marks, there is more than a million pages devoted to remote viewing.
Right.
Because what happens is that I do a workshop, and half the people do very, very well and say, that wasn't hard, I could teach that, and they go out and teach it. So there are lots and lots of people teaching remote viewing today, and my job is not so much to teach people to do remote viewing, but more to give them permission to make use of an ability they already have.
Well, I'll take a sidebar question here and say, with all of the people out there that have been trained with the ability, you know, for remote viewing, why haven't we found Bin Laden yet? And why aren't there more people out there that can say, no, it's right here, and be able to pinpoint whether, if it's in Pakistan or Afghanistan, that we'd be able to move on that information?
Well, I would say the principal reason we haven't found Bin Laden is that no one's asked us to look for him. My good friend Stephen Schwartz did a remote viewing class where the goal was to find Saddam Hussein, and I was in that class. This was something he did at the Edgar Casey Center about 4 years ago, before people had any idea where Saddam Hussein was, and the consensus was, and they drew pictures, that he would be found in the outskirts of the city of Tikrit, in a compound near a river, and there was a courtyard in the compound, and he would be in a square hole dug in the courtyard of that compound, and pictures were drawn, which he's now, Stephen Schwartz has now published, and the pictures are so accurate, and this is all confirmed, published, and the vocabulary that the people used to describe where he was sounded just like the announcer on CNN who described where he was actually found. But the program was disbanded in 1995. And I'll finish the thought in a minute, but before the top of the hour, I want to invite people to go to my website, because they can then send me emails which I can answer. So my website is espresearch.com, and okay, I'll be happy to communicate with people.
You can link up to Russell Targ just by going to coasttocoastam.com, and you can find the links there. Memoirs of a Blind Biker, Do You See What I See? We'll wrap up this part, though, and I'll ask Russell, though, if the Army has trained, as he said, a group of remote viewers, sort of seems like they would be able to have found Bin Laden by now. So what could be holding that back from happening, or what is the status that he knows of the Army or the military at large's remote viewing program? I'll ask him about finding submarines, too, which one of my favorite early stories about remote viewing, and about his daughter, the encounter he had with his daughter, his late daughter, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.